Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Many wilderness adventurers have written about remote regions of Alaska. John McPhee's book, Coming into the Country, is a classic. Now, a former student of McPhee's has written his own account of the wilds of Alaska nearly 50 years later. He traveled with legendary Alaska researchers to learn about wild places and write about climate change. People who have spent decades researching and documenting that change in remote regions are teaching younger generations what's at stake as they race to chronicle the fast pace of a transforming Arctic. What do these writers and scientists want us all to know about the future? We'll hear from them today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
From Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Ben Weisenbach's book, North to the Future, is a terrific read. It's a book that will easily appeal to anyone from scientists to outdoor enthusiasts to someone who is newly outdoors curious. I'm not done reading it, in part because we expected to bring our astute guests on in the new year for this discussion. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan was confirmed to be our guest today, but as has happened with several invitations we've extended for nearly a full year now, the senator's staff said we were set, but a staffer contacted us about a week ago and canceled, citing the Senate voting schedule. We have made it clear to Senator Sullivan that the invitation door is open and we can let a guest go for a few minutes to vote as we have in the past. We hope he will agree to join us to talk to the state soon. I'm very grateful that Ben Weisenbach, Roman Dial, and Matt Nolan were able to join us sooner than we'd planned. Ben is the author of the book North to the Future, an offline adventure through the changing wilds of Alaska. Dr. Roman Dial is a professor emeritus of mathematics and biology for Alaska Pacific University, APU, and Roman is an author, an ecologist, and wilderness traveler. Dr. Matt Nolan is a geophysicist, pilot, and chief scientist for the organization Serving Earth Science Incorporated. Thank you for shifting your schedules to make today's discussion work. So I think Roman isn't quite on the line with us yet, so instead of talking to him initially, we're going to go right to Ben. And when Roman joins us, we'll back up a bit. Ben, in the first pages of your book, you mentioned how hard it is to put down the screens that we all carry. You said when you first arrived in Alaska, you didn't know how to put it down long enough to take a good look at the world. You didn't know how, and even after walking miles in a strange land, you couldn't encounter the strangeness, couldn't silence the nervous chatter of your mind. How do you reflect on that early education on finding inner quiet now? And how do you talk to other people in their 20s about the importance of that?
Hi, Lori. Thanks so much for having me on. And I think Roman is on now, actually. I think it's one of the great questions that my generation faces. How are these digital tools that offer constant stimulation, how are they changing the texture of our daily experience and the way our minds work and the things that we pay attention to? For me, it was really hard to get a grasp on that, to even begin to feel how different my mind could be without going out into the Alaskan wilderness with some of the most extraordinary, extraordinarily skilled observers of the wild, and seeing how they relate to the place, where they look, where they walk, observing firsthand kind of their regard for the land. I think it was initially I was really stumbling all over myself and just stepping in it time after time. In time, I think the place kind of begins to teach you. And people, in Alaska began to teach me that there was just so much to see, and that there was so much that the screen, I think put to the side and was obscuring.
Do you recall, did it take you days or was it weeks before some of that nervous chatter finally got quiet? I was reflecting on my own experience in that regard. Many years ago, I left a newsroom to take a break, feeling kind of burned out, and I went to the Oregon coast for a few weeks, and it took me days to be able to stand on the shore, close my eyes and only hear the surf and not hear, as you said, the nervous chatter in my mind. So how long did it take you?
Yeah, well, it's a progressive, it's a process. I mean, I find that, you know, even in 5 minutes, you know, something can happen, right? You know, if you're focusing on your breath, or you're trying to kind of unplug and look around, you know, even just spending a few minutes outside, not looking at your phone, does something. But then, as you say, in the course of days, something very different happens. And in the course of weeks, something very, very different happens, you know, so that, you know, your senses feel heightened, and you're comfortable with quiet and with silence. And you find that you can just look at the same thing. You can look at the same landscape for you know, long stretches, and it's just sort of endlessly interesting. You also, I found that, and this is partly just a function of learning from people like Roman and Matt. It's partly just a matter of knowledge, but just over time would notice so much more. You know, you start to you know, see, oh, there's some grizzly tracks going back and forth on the bank there. Oh, maybe that means there are salmon around. Or you start to see that, you know, make connections in your mind between alders and you know, there's probably a pretty wet spot. So those kinds of, you feel more plugged in the longer I think you spend out there. So yeah, it's a whole, and I'm sure that my experience, that the way that my mind began to sort of open up to this place, it paled, you know, in comparison to a lot of locals and to folks like Roman and Matt. But just to experience it in my own small way was life-changing.
Yeah, learning how to read the land instead of read a screen is a great transformation. Roman, I understand that you've joined us now. I'm glad you're on. And I want to dedicate today's program to, it seems fitting to dedicate today's program to Dick Griffith, the wilderness adventurer, who died on December 2nd at 98, which is a great run for any of us. Roman, you met Dick when you were in your 20s, and I imagine that you probably looked up to Dick as a young guy, as Ben did when he first met you. You called Dick the grandfather of modern Alaska adventure. Give us a quick snapshot of his influence on your wilderness work.
Okay, yeah, sure. Well, I guess I was about the same age when I met Dick that Ben was when he and I went out on our first Brooks Range expedition. And when I met Dick, you know, I was, you know, pretty full of myself, a lot different than Ben. You know, I'd been climbing mountains in the Alaska Range and, you know, skiing across the interior. And so I felt like I knew a lot until I met Dick. And I met Dick in the first Alaska Mountain Wilderness Classic, which was like a 150-mile wilderness race from Hope to Homer across the Kenai Peninsula. And all of us competitors, there were only 10 of us, all nine of us other than Dick were planning on swimming these big glacial rivers that crossed the Kenai, like the Skilak River and the Kili and the Tustamina. And at the first river, you know, Dick showed up, and I'd seen him. I'd met him before the race. I'd camped in his tent because I didn't have a tent or even a sleeping bag, and he invited me to sleep in his tent. And I thought, what is this old man? He was 55 then. What is he doing here? And what could he possibly know that I don't know, you know? And I learned a lot just from seeing how Dick participated and how he nearly won the race because he brought a small inflatable raft to cross all the rivers that the rest of us swam wearing rain gear and backpacks. And that was, you know, 1982, so well over 45 years ago, or so 43 years ago. And I learned a lot from him ever since, even though I only kind of crossed paths with him on those races, and then at one time he joined a school trip. But yeah, I mean, I learned as much from Dick, not even going out into the wilderness, as you know, Ben probably learned from me and my crew. Yeah, and I miss him. I loved that man, and I really admired him for all the things that he'd done. Because besides nearly winning the first Wilderness Classic at 55, you know, he took a rubber raft down the Grand Canyon and ran all the rapids. He was the first one to do that, and he did that with his wife in like ni early 1950s. And he walked across the Brooks Range from Barter Island to Anaktuvuk Pass in 1959. And in his 60s and 70s, he did a series of ski trips from Unalakleet to Barrow to Kaktovik, and then all the way across northern Canada through the Northwest Passage to Hudson Bay. And he did that in his 60s and 70s. And I'm 65 now, and there's no way I'm going to do the things he did in his 60s and 70s. So that's Dick Griffith.
Well, thank you for that nice tribute to Dick Roman. And certainly, most of us will never have nearly the wilderness experiences that you have had. So there's plenty there. Ben, you compare your early years to Roman's many wilderness trips for research, noting that by the time you were 18, you'd logged an ungodly number of hours on YouTube, Facebook, Snapchat, but only a handful of nights in a tent. You had an anxiety about what you were missing that wasn't on the internet cloud, and you took a year to, quote, learn how to be outside. How do you talk to other young urbanites who haven't experienced wilderness? What does it mean to you to learn to be outside?
It means to me a lot of different things. You know, one of them is it's just fun. You know, I think a lot of kids feel you know, a lot of pressure. You know, when they spend a lot of time online, there's a lot of, you know, social comparison that happens online. There's a feeling that you're wrapped up in this social world. You're always kind of you know, need to perform in one way or another. And so for me to spend a year where I wasn't as focused on that, or was at least trying to sort of unplug from that and learn how to camp, you know, how to navigate, you know, on and off trail. It was an experience of paying attention to a non-human world, seeing how much there was going on out there that had really nothing to do with humans and our various machinations. And it was also about building confidence. You know, I think that when you problem solve for yourself, you develop a sense that things are going to be okay. And it's also just such an amazing way to get to know people, right? When there's not, I think that was the book is partly about these relationships that form, you know, that developed between, you know, these mentors that I had in Alaska and these French and these friends and me just through being outside and uninterrupted time, lots of long, deep conversations that are just harder to have, you know, in the trenches of daily life. So yeah, that'd be part of it.
Yeah, I appreciated you saying having a sense that things are going to be okay when you develop capabilities and skills and feel competent to take things on. It does give a greater sense of, okay, I can deal with this, I can handle this, and that helps alleviate anxiety. Thank you for that. Roman and Matt, Ben's book title starts with the Alaska state motto or slogan, North to the Future. This is more relevant today than it may have been when the state was founded. How do you see this today as opposed to more than 50 years ago? North is the future for most species, correct?
Well, sure. I mean, it is now with the climate changing the way it is, especially in the Arctic of Alaska. The permafrost is thawing, and that's letting a lot of boreal plants move north, and then following those are a bunch of boreal animals for sure. But I think Matt can talk about the glaciers and things that are happening.
Oh, did we lose Roman?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I thought thought there was a little dropout, I think.
Yeah, no, I'm here.
Okay, great. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I guess I was just going to say that, North to the Future, I think that, we're still looking north for resources. I think that the resources in the north aren't going to go away. There's resources elsewhere in the world, but there's a lot of other things in the north here, a certain amount of resiliency that we can preserve by maintaining these really large conservation areas, and the oil and the metals there aren't going to go anywhere. But having a really large intact wilderness can give organisms a way to move north and get away from, for example, these rusting rivers and climate polluted streams that are, killing fish and other organisms.
Yeah, Matt.
I guess I don't have too much to add. The first thing that came to my mind, north to the future, about glaciers that I study on the north side of the Brooks Range, is that as they melt, they're going north as well. They flow into the rivers that flow into the Arctic Ocean. So north is the future of the glaciers in the Brooks Range as well.
And we'll talk more about what's happening with rivers and things as we move along with the program. But if you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. And today we're talking about the book by Ben Weisenbach called North to the Future, An Offline Adventure Through the Changing Wilds of Alaska. On the line with us today is Ben, the author and wilderness adventurer, and also Roman Dial, wilderness adventurer, ecologist, and professor emeritus of mathematics and biology at APU is on the line. And Matt Nolan is also with us today. Matt is a geophysicist, pilot, and chief scientist for the organization Serving Earth Science Incorporated. Ben, as I noted earlier, I'm not done reading the book, but I'm curious about whether you aim to direct readers to a conclusion about wild places. We know there's been long a tension between conservationists and resource development proponents here. Your mentor, John McPhee, was on this program in 2017, and I asked him if he were trying to persuade readers toward one side or the other. He was quite definitive in his answer.
No. I see my role as a writer as somebody who would lay it all out in front of the reader and leave it to the reader to form conclusions and opinions and things like that. That would be my goal, and that's really... It's because I think it's a richer piece of writing if that's the nature of it. And so I've always tried to do that. And every once in a while, I mean, maybe twice in the whole 40-some years, I come out from behind a curtain and start shouting about something. But I don't think that polemical writing that tries to force a point is as interesting as a piece of writing. And what I'm interested in is pieces of writing.
Ben, what are your thoughts about this? Reading McPhee and taking his course at Princeton inspired you to go to Alaska as a journalist. Talk about that, how that path clarified for you and what your aim is with this book, North to the Future.
Yeah, John McPhee has been just an extraordinary mentor figure to me. I read Coming into the Country when I was a 20-year-old. Very confused about what I was going to do with my life. And I was on a camping trip. I read this book and just had this kind of aha moment, a moment of clarity. That's really, I can't really think of another moment in life that was quite like that. I'd been interested in Alaska for a long time, just because I'd been, reading lots of books about it. And, growing up in LA, it's kind of the furthest thing from the kind of place and experiences and people that I had grown up around. So it intrigued me. And when I read McPhee's book, which just painted this extraordinarily rich portrait of the place, I was, not only more enthusiastic about visiting, but also realized that perhaps if I came up with some writing project there, then I might have an excuse to get funding to go there. So McPhee was teaching a famous writing course at Princeton at the time, where I was then had just finished my freshman year, and I wrote to him saying, "I want to follow in your footsteps, literally." And by some stroke of luck, you know, he took me on, and we spent, you know, a lot of time that year talking about how I would design a project. And in the years since, he's continued to be an extraordinary mentor. But on the topic of what the aim of the writing is, you know, I think I'm quite sympathetic to John's position, especially as an outsider. You know, I think his disposition to put the polemics to the side and first try to listen and observe very closely and see what people who know the issues better than you do are thinking about it, while, you know, also maintaining an independent mind and not simply adopting the views of the people you happen to be around. I think that's a really good kind of first step for a journalist. And so that was certainly my approach to this book. You know, I felt like I'd read and heard a lot of narratives about climate change. And I was really curious to just see, you know, what are the people on the ground who are observing it directly? What are they seeing? And what will I see if I go out there and spend a lot of time in this place listening and looking? That was the approach I tried to take. And I hoped that that would also, you know, appeal to a wider audience that maybe aren't all that interested in climate change, but are interested in an adventure book. Mm. So I've tried to avoid kind of beating the reader over the head with a kind of agenda. I don't think I really, you know, I developed some clear, strong views over the course of the reporting. I hope they're fairly nuanced. And I don't really reveal my hand or even gesture in that direction until fairly late in the book. You know, I try to cite the views of other people whom I respect and many of whom disagree among themselves. Because that's the way the world is. It's messy, and these issues are all, you know, every truly interesting issue is also pretty complex. So I've tried to, you know, I think I tried to write as an sort of ethical outsider and let locals do most of the talking and then wait for a while until maybe I've built some credit up with the reader to say, you know, here's what at the end of this, you know, here's what I'm feeling.
All right. Thank you for that. On your first trip to Alaska, you climbed Denali, you met Roman and Matt and others. Roman, you met Ben at a party. That's noted in his book. Does that happen to you a lot? Young people inspired by your work want to meet you and travel with you? And if so, what makes you say yes when you're not sure if someone like Ben, a young dude from LA, is up for the rigors of backcountry travel?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. Yeah, I do get occasional emails and then, yeah, sometimes at parties, you know, people will screw up their courage and come forward and introduce themselves to me. And Ben was one of those young people. I was actually at Luke Mell's birthday party, his 40th birthday party. And the way I remember it, you know, which maybe is probably different than how Ben remembers or portrays it. But I remember him coming up to me and saying, you know, are you Roman Dial? And I was sort of like, yeah, well, who's asking? And then he told me about himself and that he was traveling around the state, meeting people in different places, and that he was a student at Princeton, and he was working on this climate change project. And of course, I asked him if he knew John McPhee or had taken a class from him, and he said yes. And so instantly, you know, that put me kind of put Ben in the positive column because, you know, I really respected his writing, McPhee's writing. I thought coming into the country and Into the Wild and Ordinary Wolves, I think those are my three favorite Alaskan books or books about Alaska. And since I didn't really know Ben, but, you know, in some ways, you know, McPhee was vouching for him. And he seemed interested in the fact that he'd been up to Utqiagvik and he'd already talked to like Matt and Kenji and other people. I was really impressed by his sort of can-do attitude. And so I invited him to go on a moose hunting trip that weekend so I could see what he was like in the field. Mm-hmm. And he joined me on that trip.
And Ben and Roman, in chapter 8, you describe this is, you know, after you went on the moose trip, and this is a trip down the road a ways, you describe tension over the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, with Roman telling you, Ben, at one point, that it's annoying to hear you make arguments on the resource development side. Talk about that exchange, and Ben, how you ultimately decided that you actually were being annoying.
Yeah, well, you know, as I recall, this was done on our first tree line research expedition, walking from the Hall Road out to the Canadian border, and we had just entered the boundaries of the Arctic Refuge, and Roman was talking some about, you know, the value of wilderness and how silly it would be to, you know, to drill for oil and risk despoiling what was one of the largest pristine wildernesses left. Roman, I may have butchered your sentiments there. But from my perspective, you know, then I was coming from, this was also coming after several weeks, of sharing a tent with Roman. And I had made a complete fool of myself, especially in the first couple of weeks. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to zip up a tent properly. I didn't know how to waterproof my stuff. I was just like, I was sort of a walking liability. And Roman was, you know, was pretty honest with me about that. And so I think I was eager for any opportunity to kind of nip back at Roman and to assert kind of my own abilities, which, you know, I felt like, okay, well, I may not be able to, you know, hold a candle to Roman in the backcountry, but maybe I can argue with him a little bit. So, you know, I started, you know, taking the counter position and sort of playing devil's advocate and talking about how, you know, drilling for oil might lower gas prices and most, you know, Americans would never get up to the Arctic Refuge. So maybe there was real benefit to, but I mean, there are, you know, there's a conversation to have there, but I think I was not, not only do I have, I come to kind of pretty different views on the matter, but I wasn't making them in good faith. I think I was just trying to argue with Roman a little bit, and he put me in my place in what was one of many kind of funny little moments of tension in the book.
We need to take a short break, but when we come back, Roman, I'd love to hear how you felt in that moment as Talk of Alaska statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the book North to the Future, an offline adventure through the changing wilds of Alaska, written by Ben Weisenbach. Ben is an author and wilderness adventurer. Also with us today is Roman Dial. Dr. Dial is a wilderness traveler, ecologist, and professor emeritus of mathematics and biology at Alaska Pacific University. And Dr. Matt Nolan is also on the line with us. Matt is a geophysicist, pilot, and chief scientist for the organization Serving Earth Science Incorporated. So, Roman, reminisce with us about that moment when you just said, "You are so annoying."
Well, I was probably taking a little of my impatience with having spent, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for a month with a bunch of 20 somethings, being in my 60s, and I can get kind of grouchy and impatient. I know that, and I have to apologize often for being that way. But yeah, when Ben, you know, and I know he was trying to be a good journalist, but he was asking the wrong person about, you know, well, isn't it important to drill for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge? And it just seemed really obvious to me why it isn't important, that there's plenty of other places as a nation to drill. And as a state, I mean, we have a lot to lose by drilling there. I know other people will disagree with me, but I got really impatient with him. You know, it was just like it was a release valve for him to kind of kick at me. It was a release valve for me to kind of respond to him. But I thought his argument was sort of absurd, because I think, you know, and this is my memory, but he said, well, a bunch of the kids at school I go to, then they don't have to pay as much for gas as they're driving across the country on a road trip, you know? And I just thought, boy, that's, you know, I wanted him to talk to some other real conservationists and see how they would reply. But that's how I remember it. But Ben was really a good sport, and he did put up with me. And we did share a tent, you know, for a month. And you know, he shared it with a grouchy old sourdough. So good on him for coming back on the next expedition as well.
Well, that's all part of the education.
One of the most amazing educational experiences of my life, honestly.
Absolutely. Matt, getting back to you, talk about your first connections with Ben and how you got involved and ended up in his book.
Wait. Those are questions that I'm not sure I have any answers to. I think that my first recollection, Ben, you have to correct me here, but I remember I ran out of gas one time and I was walking down the road and you were walking the other way or running or biking or something and flagged me down. And then you started talking about glaciers, and a few weeks later we're out there. That's about all I can recall of that. I think we must have talked, or at least on the phone, before then. Is that right?
Yeah, so that may be, I think, the first time when I sort of appeared on your radar, but I had known about you for a while by that point. So that first summer in Alaska, when I was 20, I sort of just bounced around asking people, you know, if you could talk to anyone in the state, who would you want to talk to? And very quickly, Matt was mentioned, because he just made this map of Denali that was far more precise, with much higher resolution than the USGS map. And he'd done it in, what was it, a day of flying? And so that was in the news. And, you know, I'd also, that from there, I'd looked up and seen that, you know, learn more about his research on McCall. Here was this guy who was really the only person doing you know, in situ field work in Arctic Alaska's glaciers. You know, the other people studying it, but here was this guy who was actually flying there in his own plane and studying these glaciers. And I was just interested, you know, who is this person who's doing this? What drives someone to do that? And also I was interested in the technologies that he was developing to do that work. So I emailed Matt. I'm not sure I'd gotten a response, but I booked a flight to Fairbanks and I called him when I arrived, and he said, "Hey, I'm at the airport right now, at the airport, you know, sure, you can come watch me get my propeller repaired." So I went over there, and that was the first time we met.
And
you actually, you took me up in your plane, in the plane, that time, you know, we were talking, and you were getting your propeller repaired, because, you know, in all this, research, you were actually mapping the refuge that summer, the 1002, area. Wow. And you had some damage on the plane. And they said, "Well, you want to fly?" And I was like, "Hell yeah." So, that was our first meeting.
So Matt,
but you also,
2018.
Yes, sir. That was 2018. Yeah,
Matt, you've been studying glaciers for decades now. Talk about some of your observations of change in that time.
Well, I guess for the past 25 years, I've been focusing on glaciers in the Eastern Branch within the Arctic Refuge, and in particular, one glacier that's got a research history that goes back to 1957. So it's the only. It's the only glacier in Arctic Alaska with any significant research history at all, lasting more than a few years, and one of only a handful, three or four,
Matt,
across the state with any similar.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're having some issues with the audio, so Madeline's going to try and just call you and reestablish, and so we'll come back to that in just a moment, okay? Sorry about that.
Sure.
But yeah, we want to make sure we have good, clear audio there. So Roman and Matt, or Roman, let's, I'm going to turn to you for a moment here. What talk about your observations about the behavior of animals as the climate changes. Beyond moving farther north, do they exhibit more aggression or signs of stress or illness more than 30 years ago?
Well, you know, I can only speak to, that's a great question, Lori, but I can only sort of provide anecdotal evidence that I've witnessed. And, you know, I'll just start with the biggest and the baddest of the animals in some sense up there. And those would be the grizzly bears. And I've found that the grizzly bears, particularly in the Western Brooks Range, are really a lot pushier than they used to be. I mean, they've always been, you know, kind of in June, especially, they're waiting for the caribou to come round and drop their calves, because the bears hibernate all winter and wait for these caribou to come. And then they live on caribou in the spring. And then by July, they're eating parka squirrels. And then I guess, you know, in the late summer, they're moving to berries. And the caribou herds there, the Western Arctic caribou herd has crashed. And the parka squirrels are, I mean, I'm shocked they're gone. And I'm not the only one who's noticed that. You know, the Arctic ground squirrel, which is, you know, also called a parka squirrel, they're vastly diminished. And so the grizzly bears are just really pushy. And, you know, Ben was with Ben and I and some APU alumni were on the research expedition in 2021. And we were followed by a grizzly bear, a very curious and pushy grizzly bear for 2 days.
Yikes.
And then we finally had to have this real nerve-wracking showdown that Ben describes really well in his book. But I'd say that's the problem that has really challenged my wilderness travel there. But the caribou were going in different places. They've quit their migration paths, like through Onion Portage, where they've been going, I don't know, for how many decades or centuries or even millennia, and they're not crossing it at Onion Portage on the Kobuk River anymore. So all the big animals, in especially the Western Brooks Range, are really changing their behaviors.
Mm. Matt, I understand you're back with us now. Hopefully we have a good connection. The glacier study work that you were talking about and you're conducting has been going on since 1957. You took over in 2003. That's an amazing length of study. How rare is that? And how does it compare to the length of other glacier studies?
It's reasonably rare. I mean, there's only a handful. There's like two USGS glaciers, two or three others run by other people. So, you know, in the state of Alaska, you know, maybe five or six, depends how you want to add these things up. Worldwide, I think, you know, something on the order of 100 out of the 200,000 glaciers that exist out there, I mean, outside of Greenland and Antarctica. So, yeah, there's not a lot. Nobody really wants to fund long-term glacier research or long-term research into anything in the field. In terms of funding agencies and the government, they don't want to set themselves on the hook for, you know, long-term stuff like that. It is expensive, and, you know, they want to put their money where things are most interesting, and, you know, I kind of get that, but it is a struggle. I mean, considering how many glaciers there are and how few long-term baseline studies there are, it makes our job challenging in terms of figuring out what's actually happening out there. It's gotten a lot easier now with a lot more satellite techniques, a lot more modeling stuff going on, so you get a better handle on it globally. But you still need boots on the ground. You still need stakes in the snow. You still need weather stations locally. Otherwise, you're really just kind of guessing at things that increase your uncertainties and decrease your ability to predict accurately. It's not that common.
Shouldn't, you were saying that scientists want to look at things that are more interesting, but what's more interesting than understanding the changes that are happening that are going to affect all of us, regardless of how close we are or are not to glaciers? That is a tremendous amount of the world's fresh water supply. It's all kinds of things. It's habitat creation. It's, as you well know, it does so, glaciers do so much. Why isn't there more interest in better understanding their loss?
You tell me. I have no idea. You're preaching to the choir. Yeah, it's a struggle we all face, right? I mean, how do we, it's not a matter of communication. I mean, the data's there. I mean, nothing, I've been doing this for 40 some years now, And our story hasn't changed really a bit in all that time. I mean, we're getting more accurate, more precise, all this kind of stuff with our predictions. But the general story, climate change is real, glaciers are melting, sea levels rising, this is affecting all the things you just said, that's never changed. Yet, you know, half the people in the country don't believe, in our country don't believe it. That's not a matter of better education or, you know, throwing more, you know, adding more data points to the mountain of data that we have is not going to change any more hearts and minds here. I can't say for sure what is, but, you know, if I could, I would be doing it. But it's not more data. And I think we all suffer from that in some way.
Yes, we do. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the book North to the Future as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the book North to the Future, an offline adventure through the changing wilds of Alaska with author Ben Weisenbach. Also, we have Roman Dial, wilderness traveler and professor emeritus of APU on the line with us, and Matt Nolan, geophysicist, pilot, and chief scientist for Serving Earth Science is also with us today. Ben, early in the book, you describe finding saplings, lots of them sprouted in the tundra, advancing north from the Brooks Range. Roman said, "This is gold." You wrote that it was thrilling, but you had no sense of what it meant. And you said you thought maybe Roman did not either. How do you see that moment now, and what has it come to mean to you?
Yeah, it's a great question. First, before we get to that point, I just wanted to circle back to something Matt just said. I mean, you asked about these long-term research projects and why they're so hard to fund. And as Matt said, it is sort of mind-boggling. I mean, these long-term studies are the most reliable way of understanding how our world, our planet is changing. And sometimes it's exciting and grabby to go study some new place that's going to be suggestive in some kind of way. But knowing, for example, how McCall Glacier and the glaciers of the Romanzoff Mountains are changing is valuable, not just because it shows that, you know, our climate is warming, but also because the way these glaciers change may tell us something about how Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheet, how those ice sheets are gonna change. So, anyways, there are very few things that I get sort of worked up about. But in my mind, the fact that someone like Matt is going out and risking his life to collect this data, you know, more than 100 miles from the road, and that it's so tricky to get funding to go and do that work is. It's frustrating. And if anyone's interested in what Matt's doing, he's too modest, too humble to say it, but, you should check out Serving Earth Science, Inc. That's where he is doing his work now. On the question of what these little seedlings mean, you know, I think most of us, so that scene describes, you know, that first expedition from the Hall Road across the eastern Brooks Range to the Canadian border, we were studying how the northern tree line's responding to changes in the climate. Is it moving northwards or not? And we found a bunch of seedlings growing north of the tree line. And, you know, at the time, I didn't really know what that meant. You know, I think most people's intuitions when you hear about trees growing in the Arctic is, oh, well, you know, trees are great because they perform photosynthesis and they take carbon out of the atmosphere and they fix it as wood. That's why it's bad to chop down the Amazon rainforest, for example. But and that's true to some extent, but there's a lot of other changes that happen in that process too. So one of them is that trees, by and large, are darker than the surfaces they cover, than the tundra, which is often covered by snow. So these dark surfaces, like, you know, a dark shirt or a black shirt on a sunny summer day, you know, that absorbs more energy, these trees also absorb more solar energy. And there's other effects, consequences in terms of how trees change the insulation of permafrost. which is, you know, frozen soil that stores a great deal of carbon. And early on in these expeditions, you know, I really didn't understand just how complex that all of those different effects are and how difficult it is to net them out. And, you know, Roman had a much better sense, but I think as time went on, we were all learning just how complex the relationship between climate and trees and permafrost and other ecological kind of disturbances could be.
And Roman, I understand that this there's an area of forestation that's happening in that region that is migrating faster than any other place on Earth. And I shouldn't have referred to them as saplings. Clearly, they're just seedlings. But in an earlier interview, Roman, you mentioned you were fertilizing trees at the tree line to see if it would increase their growth rate, which was kind of surprising to me. Why do that? Why try to manipulate the growth rather than just observe what's happening on its own?
Sure. Well, it's, I guess the easiest answer would be that if we just sort of observe things, then all we can really infer is correlation between one thing and another, you know, correlation between warming, for example, and tree growth. But we don't really know what's causing, you know, the increased growth. And so one hypothesis or one idea or one guess at what's happening is that as the atmosphere warms, then the soil warms and the microbes, the organisms that live in the soil and rot the organic matter, as the soil's warming, they're releasing more nutrients that the trees can absorb and thereby grow faster. So to test that idea, we fertilized these trees right at tree line to see if we gave them, you know, the same kind of fertilizer, you know, nitrogen, phosphorus and potassium that we put on our lawns or on our vegetables or our houseplants, if that would increase the growth rate of the trees at tree line, to sort of pinpoint the mechanism, you know, how it's actually happening, and to prove that warming could cause this increased growth.
John McPhee talked about a river in the Brooks Range that when he was there in the 70s, the 1970s, was the cleanest water he'd ever seen. Roman and Matt, give us a visual of how the Arctic, the rivers of the Arctic region, the tundra, the mountains, look today compared to when you first visited them decades ago.
Do you want me to answer that first, or do you want to go
ahead,
Matt?
Go ahead.
Okay, sure. Well, I think my first trip to the Brooks Range was in 1979, and I spent a month up there climbing rocks and in a base camp. And, you know, we never treated our water. We just drank the water straight out of the streams. And then I revisited the Brooks Range, you know, every few years until I got older. I could go up there every year. And I never really treated the water I never felt the need to treat the water until 2020, which was a warm year following one of the hottest years on record, at least in Kotzebue, where they have the longest sort of Arctic temperature record in Alaska. And the water was turning orange. Like there's a river called the Clear River, and it was no longer clear. You know, the pilots called it the Not Clear River, and it was orange and greenish. And when we made our powdered milk, it would curdle our powdered milk. And then I sent two of the young members of our expedition out looking for clean water, and they couldn't find any. And then the next day we hiked up this weirdly colored stream and came to an orange waterfall. And along the way we found a clear creek. And I thought, oh, finally some clear water. And I bent over to slurp it, you know, right from the stream with my lips. And I had to spit it out immediately. You know, I've never tasted battery acid, but this stuff tasted really bad. I mean, it was like it metals and acidic. It kind of burned my mouth, and I just spit it out. And I was alarmed by this. And my collaborator, Patty Sullivan from the University of Alaska at Anchorage, he had been, as part of our research on tree line, he's the one who introduced me to the project. He was working on our site on the Salmon River, and the river had gone, you know, orange and green, and they ran into grizzly bears that were really aggressive, and he thought that the bears were aggressive because they couldn't see the salmon anymore, and they were used to fishing for salmon by sight rather than by feel. And so this really alarmed us. And now the Salmon River, you know, looks like sometimes some years or sometimes of the year it looks like tomato soup. Other times it looks like pea soup. And this is the river that John McPhee said, you know, was the cleanest water he'd ever seen flowing over rocks. And most of the river, it might not be toxic to humans, but it is chronically toxic in aluminum and iron and cadmium to aquatic life, you know, like plankton and those you know, little bugs that live at the bottom, like caddisfly larvae and mayfly larvae and stonefly larvae that fishermen use to catch, you know, to tie their flies, and that the fry of salmon and Dolly Varden trout feed on. So it's really alarming to see in my lifetime a place where I could drink any water anytime without treatment to water now that's toxic to the organisms that live there.
And Matt, in our final minute here, I want you to pick it up there too. And just that is alarming when I think about, I've been in Alaska for almost 27 years, and just in that amount of time, I've observed change in my own yard in Anchorage in the 22 years I've lived there, which is an eye blink in the climate scale, kind of terrifying the pace of it all. So Matt, your thoughts about these changing rivers and what it kind of means, what you want to leave people with for a message?
Well, I can say since this project I'm leading now, which started 1957, half the glaciers in the Arctic Refuge have disappeared since then. You know, they're the smaller glaciers, but still half a number that were identified in the topo maps from back then. And the impact on the rivers is that, you know, in the rivers in the North Slope and in the Arctic Refuge, Hulu, Jago, Akpilik, those, they're primarily glacier fed. So the Dolly Varden that came in from the ocean, they're coming in through glacier meltwater. So if the glaciers disappears, which is in the process of happening, what's going to happen to those fish? And the deltas that are at the end of these rivers that enter the ocean, you know, tens of thousands of migratory birds come here every year, but those deltas are made of glacial silt that's carried with the meltwater. So if the glaciers disappear, the water disappears, the silt disappears, what's going to happen to the ecology that depends on the rivers and those deltas? It's an open question. I don't know.
And Ben, to close out the show today, talk about how you're trying to help people your age really pay attention, connect to nature. We're so distracted by screens, as you note in your book, taking photos, taking notes, rather than just immersing. You went through a period of that, rather than just immersing yourself. Talk about how you talk to younger folks about this, and close us out. Got about 30 seconds or so.
Okay, that's a tall task.
I know.
My feeling is that there's a lot of fear and negativity around our environmental crisis, and with good reason. And yet, I think in so many ways, spending time in Alaska, in the Arctic up there, was filled me with a lot of hope, because for all these really radical changes that are happening, it's still a really wild, spectacular place. It's inspiring. And I found that I had so much to gain just by putting down, you know, the phone, by learning how to pay attention to the natural world. I can only describe through the book just what a important kind of discovery that was for me. I think a lot of young people are also feeling that something isn't quite right, and that these devices are doing things to us that we don't like. And so I think the more we can sort of share our stories about how we're finding ways out, ways to put this technology in its place, not to toss it aside, but to use it well.
Use it as a tool and not let it consume us. So put down the device and pick up a book like North to the Future, an offline adventure through the changing wilds of Alaska. Thanks to our guests, Ben Weisenbach, Roman Dial, and Matt Nolan. And thanks to our engineer, Crystal Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, our editor, Annie Fite, and on the phones, Wesley Early was standing by to help us out. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
To Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.